This is WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carborough, your voice in the community. You're listening to Psych Talk, bringing you all kinds of stories and research on psychology, neuroscience, and the social sciences. Today, our show is going to be a little backward sideways, not quite in the rhythm you're used to, because, first of all, the intro is going to be different. And rather than explain that, I'm just going to let it go. Sally, if you want to take the floor.
First of all, my name is Sally Rhinefeather. I'm going to be talking about life growing up with my parents, Dr. Joseph Banks Rhine, and my mother, Louisa Rhine. My father, I'll call him JB, has been called the father of modern parapsychology. So growing up in his household was, you know, maybe of interest. Mm-hmm. But he came to be called that by a circuitous route. JB had planned to be a minister, but lost his religion when he encountered science courses in college as a young man way back at the beginning of the 1900s. Mm. He and his childhood friend, my mother, Louisa Weckesser, got married in 1920 after all this, and decided to make a life as scientists, left their farm families in Ohio to go off to the University of Chicago, where they worked their way through and obtained doctorates in plant physiology, botany, and that was going to be their career. But while they were at the University of Chicago, they ran into ideas that set them off course a little, that led them to question whether the materialistic philosophy of the day of the sciences at that time, and probably still even today, was that all there was? For instance, was there anything more? Was there something to life after death? These were religious questions which they had abandoned, but they wondered if there was any scientific evidence for anything like that. They ran into some things which made them think possibly there was, and that would be in the realm of what was called psychical research then. we call it parapsychology today. And after some, they left plant physiology and academic careers teaching. And my father retrained himself into psychology and eventually came down to Duke University in the late 20s to consult with Professor William McDougall, who at that time was just starting the very first department of psychology at the new Duke University. It was a new place. McDougall was a British psychiatrist, psychologist, who was open-minded, not a believer in particular, but he was open-minded to matters of this kind and thought they could be studied in a university setting. So JB had a mentor then, and together they puzzled over whether they could study the survival question in any scientific way. Finally decided that they couldn't, that there was no way of conclusively of coming to an answer. But what they could do was look to see if living human beings had abilities that are known as psychic. And of course, through all history and all cultures and religions, there are many reports of this kind, but had not been systematically studied in any scientific way for more than one or two experiments until they began. Out of this work came the Duke Parapsychology Laboratory in 1934, which my father headed, and of which today, we still have that work going on. It's now called the Rhine Research Center. It is a successor to that early work that began at Duke University, no longer at Duke, since 1965. My parents, J.B. and Louisa, had four children. I'm the oldest daughter, and I'm the one in the family who has continued this work, at least partly, and now in recent years I have, particularly after several decades as a clinical psychologist. I have now retired from that and am now taking my energies, as such as I have in my early 80s, to be involved as the executive director emeritus. Now, I should add before I finish about the background that my mother, Louisa, was always interested in the experimental research. That was her interest along with my father's. They were always a pair. But she is best known for a sidetrack that she took somewhere along in the research after they felt that the experimental evidence was good enough that they could continue. And then she began paying more attention to the reports that people sent in, their experiences. So between 1948 until she finished that project in 1971, she actively collected and studied over 14,000 reports, that the letters that the public would send in to her. And that led to about 18 academic articles and quite a few books. So that's the background to where we are today.
Thank you, Sally. So that's got all kinds of interesting history there that you talked about, and it's got a very personal connection to you. So let me introduce you proper. On this show, we're going to follow the story of the Rhines, as you just started to hear laid out, beyond their research legacy by speaking with one of their daughters, Dr. Sally Rhinefeather, who's speaking with us. And as she said, she's the Executive Director Emeritus at the Rhine Research Center. And like she said, she's an experimental and clinical psychologist. She's continued on some of the work of her parents. And she co-wrote a 2005 book called The Gift, ESP, The Extraordinary Experiences of Ordinary People. We're not going to go per se into the research of ESP and Psi. You've spoken a lot about that before. You've written about that. You know, we have this public record of the father of psychology and his family and what he accomplished. And I want to dig behind that and get to know what it's like to be his daughter, what it's maybe what sort of insights you have from your own life and from his life that can help round out the picture for us. And I think this is an important type of interview we haven't done on Psych Talk, where you just speak with someone about their greatest area of expertise, which is their life, and get all the insights that flow out of that, just from sort of profiling them and letting them flow, letting them finally have a platform. So that's what we're going to do. But in order to set that up, I mean, one of the important elements of this whole discussion is your family. So for my benefit, as well as for the benefit of the listeners, let's walk through your family tree. If you could tell us about your siblings a little bit, any aunts and uncles that were influential in your life, that sort of thing.
Okay. Yeah, I'm very interested in this. I'm also, you know, was a family psychologist, so I think that the understanding of anybody is to look at them in context. We are not individual, we're not islands. We are all embedded in our history and in our current family. And so that's where we are now. Mm-hmm. My family background was both my parents were from farm families. They were the first in their family to go to college, if not the only ones in some case. And they were the oldest children, primarily, who sort of worked their way up and worked their way through. They're from simple, very simple, but there's an element on both sides of my family of people who were interested in more than one grandfather started a newspaper and another one was always reading big books, you know, and there weren't many books in those days at all around in those poor families. Yeah. But so that history of knowledge, interest in knowledge and curiosity came into their life at an early age. They left their farm families, and, you know, stayed close, but there were no other people that were influential. They found their mentors outside their family. They found father substitutes in many ways. Huh. And they had each other, which is remarkable. We should all be so lucky as to find a partner very early in life. They met over discussions. My mother was older than my father. She was actually teaching school because she didn't have enough money to go to college. So she was teaching school when she encountered this bright teenage boy who was different from the others because he read books. And they had arguments about religion. He was still religious at that time, and she had broken away from her Mennonite background. So they argued over that and women's rights and things like that. So,
and it sounds like she won some of those arguments.
She did. She actually did. They were both very competent and bright people. And so they formed a life partnership, which lasted until they were both in their 80s. And my mother lived beyond him. But that was extremely important. He couldn't have done it without her, and she couldn't have done it without him. And they complemented each other. So that was my family background, knowing these two strong people, independent people. But my mother, the softer, more ideal mother that didn't get upset and, you know, kept her cool. Mm-hmm. And siblings. Then I have an older brother who I tangled with. That was probably the bane of my early life, high school at least, age.
Well, how close was he to you in age?
He was just less than 2 years older.
Okay, so I could see how that would lead to tangles.
Yeah. And I had two younger sisters to whom I never had any problem, but I didn't have a partner within the family of the siblings. I wasn't particularly involved with my siblings. So that was kind of our family setting.
Mm-hmm. All right. So you had parents from simple beginnings, but big ambitions, and they, you know, they were well-read. They wanted to learn more. You had two younger sisters and an older brother. Just quickly, I'm curious, which side grandfather was the one who tried to start a newspaper, or did start a newspaper?
That was my mother's family. Okay. My mother worked as her. Mm-hmm. There's a whole life story behind him. You know, I love these family myths. His father had come over from Germany, shipwrecked off the coast of New Jersey, and what we would call now had a near-death experience because he clung to the mast while others drowned. Man. And then after that, his whole life was devoted to religious beliefs and things like that. He had a a real strong. My mother broke away from those beliefs because they were very pretty narrow. But that, you know, near-death experiences we know do transform people's lives.
Of course,
For generations thereafter, probably.
Right, and I can't say that from experience. I haven't had a near-death experience.
No, I haven't even. Thank goodness.
But it definitely seems you can tell. Looking around people in our culture, that seems to be really moving. Mm-hmm. So, of course, what we're trying to get to here as we start with your family, and we've set that up, thank you, is to explore your childhood and how it shaped you and what experiences you had with your parents. So let's start with place. Just tell us about where you grew up and if you did much traveling within mm-hmm. your town or outside of that.
No, you know, life seemed to me now, compared to my own grandchildren's life and probably your life, seemed pretty simple. And this was in the early 1900s. This was in Durham, North Carolina, which was back then not nearly as exciting as it may be now. And you can even, but anyway, won't go into that. But
well, did you have the Bull Stadium, for example?
No.
No,
I mean, yeah, what was there to do? What was life without that? Yeah. We had we did have a 3-acre place over near now where Northgate Shopping is now, with of trees and an old barn, where it was a center place for the neighborhood kids to come and play softball. I mean, we did have a lot in that way. And our parents were outdoors people. So every weekend there were hikes or outdoor events. So it was very much a peopled world for me growing up, of friendly people, mostly around my dad's, almost always around my dad's work. I could bring my friends along and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, no, but Durham in that days was very, very simple. We walked to school and then high school. And I can't think of anything that was particularly interesting in that time other than it was just the traditional, comfortable life. My father felt if you were unconventional in one area, which he clearly was by his profession, then you better be conventional in other ways.
He's balancing it out.
Exactly. And then back in those days, that meant you didn't mow the lawn on Sunday afternoon because it was church day.
Wow.
People would upset the neighbors or something.
That's interesting.
You don't think of that anymore now, but the world was very simple. We didn't lock our doors. As children, I don't remember at all.
So simple life, security.
Yep, no crime. Or the world was divided. There was a white world and the black world. Then it was the segregated right. South. And because my parents were informed and enlightened and liberal, we were aware of these injustices around us. But that was the world the way it was. And you adapted to it. High school was a white high school.
So you walked to school, and excuse my ignorance about history, was that something everyone was doing?
Sure. Watts Street School was, you know, about a half a mile away, and Durham High School was not quite a mile away. Hmm. I mean, you were lucky if somebody gave you a ride or you could afford the bus now and then, but that's right. Just what you did.
Yeah. So good exercise, I suppose.
Yeah, probably. And it probably wasn't as much physical exercise. Well, I don't know what there is now, any different.
Yeah, I mean, we have PE. Mm-hmm. Since we're there, maybe we can talk a little bit about, let's start with elementary school, sure. Or the earliest memories of schooling. Mm-hmm. What do you remember about your classes, your classmates? What are the emotional memories mm-hmm. that get pulled out from that?
Well, I moved from a county school. I skipped the first grade. My mother taught all three of us girls to read and write, basically. Mm. And that meant we didn't go to the first grade, where you didn't learn a lot in those days anyway. Mm. And so I started a year younger, and that wasn't any problem. Then moved into the city schools, which were Watts Street School, which was considered the best school at the time. I just remember remember elementary school as being an interesting time. Probably after school, and my parents' environment, the home environment, was probably the best thing. I would take my friends up to the Duke Lab, which was a couple blocks away, to participate as a subject in the ESP test. Hmm. My parents were doing that. For me was just matter of fact. Although it gave me a little special up, you know, with my friends that they would do that. Hmm. Our friends were faculty people. So it was a safe, comfortable, we were on the Duke campus, women's campus, as it was called then, much of the time. So life was comfortable and interesting, and school was not particularly noticeable one way or the other. High school, I began to dislike it more. I did it, but I felt if you were smart and you know, just average even, it seemed to me, it didn't help you any. You had to sort of act dumb to fit in. And I was envious of a couple of my friends who were boys who got scholarships, professors' kids got scholarships to college, private schools.
Yeah.
I would have liked to have gone away to a more stimulating academic environment, although I might have been too shy to do it.
That's interesting. Well, we're going to get back to that, but sure. I do want to step back to the one thing you said about taking friends to the ESP lab.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When did that start? Do you remember?
I remember the third grade. That was probably when I was about 9 years old or 7 or 8 years, no longer there. Yeah.
And your friends, you were actually, they were volunteering as subjects in experiments?
Yeah. There were no IRBs then, as you know, for academic research.
Right.
And if you want to come along, you know, I'm looking for, and of course they gave little candy bars or toys. So it was definitely of interest to kids to come to. No, it was just a natural, we'd just walk over there and go, then walk home afterwards.
Huh. I do want to clarify, IRBs, institutional review boards,
right? Oh, yes, right.
So universities have review boards that'll look at proposed studies to make sure they're ethical, that they'll actually accomplish meaningful research.
That's right.
So those weren't around.
That's right. And parents' permission. Well, of course, these little children always had their parents' permission, but it wasn't all signed and documented like it would have
legalistic.
To be today.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you said it was very matter of fact to take them over. So you didn't have a sense around third grade, maybe a little later, that what your father was doing and I guess what your mother would jump into as well was strange or odd or out of the ordinary?
Well, no. I mean, I was already beginning to realize that, you know, because other people would tell me that. I remember this Mrs. McDougall one day got fussed at us little children. We were making a lot of noise and she said, "You know, you must remember your father is a famous man and you must behave better than this." And that was my first realization that other people saw him as different. It was a friendly community. He was a big name in town at that point in time at Duke University. and our friends were involved. Many of them were the children of other people who were working in his lab. So it was a more of a community. A little bit like we have now. We have a community, but without a community, you might have felt strange, I think. But we were, and Durham, North Carolina in those days was, like I say, much more laid back and safe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And when
secure, I guess, is the word.
Right. And I guess it was a smaller place and maybe a little more homogenous.
Exactly. There was only one or two schools, you know, on our side of town.
Probably. Yeah. Well, you say that your father was well known in the community, and it sounds like that was mostly a positive way in which he was known. There was a positive attitude towards your family.
Right. The skepticism that there was, and it always has been, it will be forever and ever, no matter what. That was a lot of it was intellectual. I mean, it was coming on an intellectual level. It wasn't the neighbors or anything. And as I said, we were conventional. We were well known in the neighborhood. My mother and father were active in some community things, not heavily because they were so busy, but they were centers. I mean, people liked them. They were well known in a positive way.
Right. Good. Well, let's keep bouncing between little Sally herself and her family. Let's jump to what her or your dream job might have been, or what you aspired to. Did you want to be a firefighter? I guess it would have been something a little more stereotypical, just culturally.
I don't remember having big plans for my future. It's what I wanted to be. That just doesn't come to mind at all. Later on, and as I got into high school, I think I was always interested in psychology. And I mean, broadly speaking, not just what my father was doing. Mm-hmm. But I was surrounded by a lot of psychologists around, and that just seemed what they were doing was interesting.
Right.
But I liked the outdoors, too, and, you know, something involved with nature or being outdoors would have been
Nature and the outdoors.
Mm-hmm. My parents were very much outdoors people. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we were that's what we did for, you know, for free time. There wasn't television. It wasn't even television until I was in the sixth grade, and we certainly didn't have it until any time in my family growing up. Mm-hmm. So what was there to do? We did have a big yard. We did have a horse one time, and we had pets. My sister went into animals, and she raised dogs. That was her interest, which probably began in childhood. But there weren't a lot of options, you know, to me. I knew I wanted to be something important. I wasn't going to be just as my mother before me. I was always her strife in life. I don't want to just be an ordinary person. I want to do something unusual.
That's interesting. And what happened to the horse, by the way?
We had the horse one summer, a pony, actually. He stayed in the barn until my sister fell off of him and broke her leg. And that ended the pony period in our lives.
Right, right. Well, you didn't have a dream job then, but I'm curious about another thing that young girls sometimes get fixated to that's related to the future, I guess, which is boys. And I'm curious if that I think probably I could expect some conservatism compared to today, but maybe as early as middle school, did you start scrawling in notebooks like, I'm looking for my Prince Charming, or this person is cute?
I think I went through the usual, mostly daydreaming. I was a shy, I didn't have brought this up, but I think by my standards, who I am today and who my children and grandchildren are, that I was much shyer than a lot of people. And I was probably like my husband, whom I met in later in college, my present husband now, says even in college, he considered me one of the nerdy, the smart group, you know, not the intellectual, not the outgoing athletic type or something. But and I probably portrayed that. So I didn't date seriously. I had a few dates, and only a few dates in high school. Quite the opposite of what I would expect young people of today. Right. But I certainly had my daydreams and my interests. But
yeah, that makes sense.
They weren't striking.
Well, this shyness is interesting because you're definitely not shy now, right? What happened?
Not on the outside. You never know what people really are. Don't you? Who's an introvert and who isn't?
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure. Yeah, I'm like that too. Yeah, here I am on a radio show, and I'm pretty introverted.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think an introverted means a person who can be happy thinking with their own thoughts. It doesn't have to have stimulation, but can may like the stimulation, and I do, but I don't. I get overstimulated at times and retreat into my little corner.
Yeah. I think that sums it up. That's fair. Mm-hmm. But then you think that shyness was something that faded pretty quickly, or in exterior appearances? Is it something more in your adulthood you came across as less shy over time?
I think it's something of an adulthood and dealing with the real world.
Right.
I used to tell my mother my one criticism of the way they raised us was not to teach me to be street smart, which with all of its context, the good and the bad. I mean, knowing how to deal with people, going up if you need a job, how to just go right in there and ask for it, and et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So I think that I was slow in learning that and had to learn that by trial and error. And I think my parents in their own way were very quaint and very Victorian. Now they were open-minded. Victorian. They were very understanding and open. And I can't ever remember really being reprimanded. Well, I think once when I used a four-letter word, but I was an adult by that time.
Oh.
My mother was shocked.
Huh.
But can you believe that? Getting that long in life before you had any real, run-in with authorities.
So you don't have any memory of your father really scolding you or chasing you around the house or nothing like that?
No, he might have done some of my brother, yes. But I learned, second child, watching older child getting in trouble. Boy, don't you learn? And I learned to be a family therapist and a pleaser and how to manipulate the system. Yeah.
Interesting. So would you say your older brother was the troublemaker?
Yeah. Okay. He would probably say that too.
The only troublemaker?
Probably. My younger sister was pretty rambunctious, but was more like an outgoing, and she would be doing things, crazy things that she would have climbed up on the roof, but I would never have done that.
Right, right. Okay, so yeah, really, I get this impression of like a pretty placid childhood, and I don't know if it's nostalgia that's getting mixed in or ironing out things. We have to be aware of that, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think there's a certain amount of that. Having dealt with families who had really problems, I thought, wow, we didn't have alcoholism, we didn't have child abuse. I would say my father was a workaholic, and that was the trouble in the family that caused us our different reactions, that he was so involved, over-involved with his work.
Yeah.
He was, loving and kind and all that, but you knew his mind was on something else rather than what you were trying to tell him.
Maybe a little distanced.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
But workaholic, probably much better than alcoholic and a lot of other alcoholics.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. Right. Well, Sally, I'm going to give us a break just so we can take a breather. We're going to play a little music, and we'll come back, and maybe we'll talk a little bit more about your personality, politics of the time, all kinds of other things. Mm-hmm. Listening to Psych Talk. We bring you some psychology, neuroscience, and social science every week. And today we are profiling Sally Rhinefeather, who's the Executive Director Emeritus at the Rhine Research Center. And we're talking about the legacy of her family, of her father, J.B. Rhine, and her mother, Louisa E. Rhine, and about what her experience was growing up and how that can inform who she is today as a researcher, as a psychologist, as just another human being. And we just left off talking about some aspects of her childhood, about how she was shy, about how her memories of her childhood are pretty placid. And as a family therapist, she got a lot of perspective about some of the maybe benefits she had of growing up as a Rhine and in a nice, quiet community without any big conflagrations in the house. But I wanted to talk a little bit more about your personality, because you were shy. You learned to maneuver the family so that they're to minimize conflict, I suppose. Is that fair?
I think I learned that the way to get my parents' attention the most was to go with what they were interested in. When I was discussing this with my sister recently, who has become, both my sisters were artistic types, and they went off in different ways, although they ultimately ended up doing artistic work. I think I could have gone in that direction, but the interesting thing is that when I was a young child, were the other people around the house, they were all talking about exciting things. They had just discovered precognition, or they'd done this, or they'd done that. And they were so excited. And not to have gotten some of that, you know, I think that carried with me. I still feel that today, that they were doing, quote, important things.
Right.
Now, I can imagine an undertaker's family thinking that his work was the most important thing that could be done. And his oldest daughter thinking, oh, wow, I'm going to do that too.
You know, right.
Without the content of it even being so.
But feeling came across.
The feeling was definitely there. And I think I got more of it. I absorbed more of it because of my personality, because I was quiet and I was around the house a lot. There wasn't a lot of other things to do.
So what I'm reading is that you felt like getting immersed in the psychology and the experiments was for you a more important channel to get to know your parents than it was for your siblings, maybe?
Yeah, I think because of the nature of where I was in the family unit, and so I just absorbed more of it, and I met more of the important, quote, important people that were coming around. Some interesting people like the Burl Ives and entertainers of the day would stop in, so I got some of the glamour part of it. By that time, I was 15 years old. You're looking at a picture of me when I was about 15 or 16.
Yeah, let's talk about that since you're
right.
Pointing at it. I printed out a little picture for us. And I think they were both taken around the same time.
Probably.
We have two pictures.
Yeah.
There's like a white tile wall in the background. There's a pretty simple wooden table. And I'm assuming that's J.B. Ryan on the left.
No, actually, that's Dr. Charles Stewart.
Oh, okay. So I'll let you continue explaining.
Yeah. Dr. Charlie Stewart was a dice throwing machine.
Mm.
Must have been the 1950s or late 40s, in which they had just invented this machine to throw dice so that people could study the effect of mental influence on the falling of dice. And it was improving the methodology of its time.
Looks like a little catapult or ramp.
Exactly. So okay. Automatically, actually have one that operates today, the old type. Okay, there I am at about 15 years old, looking like I'm the experimenter and writing, or maybe I'm the subject and I'm writing something down. At that point in time, I was working. My first job was checking the data. Everything had to be rechecked in those days. You didn't have computers.
Right.
So there I was working there, and I'm being used as a subject in the picture, many of the pictures of that era. So that brought me in among with some interesting things that were just, they beat what most of my friends were doing at that age, you know. So
right,
I looked at it then as exciting, and it is now, yeah.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about your experience with the lab around 15, around being a mid-teenager, because it's so fascinating to me, having seen psychology research today, so computer-based, and thinking about what it would have been like to have, I suppose, just really paper-based data.
Absolutely.
And even back then also, computers did not refer to machines. I think it referred to people.
Oh,
right? I think I've been told that computers in some contexts, like a Harvard astronomy laboratory, might mean a group of people, mostly women, who are doing calculations for the researchers,
mm-hmm.
who are computing certain results.
Okay, that could have been, yeah, absolutely.
Right.
I didn't have to do that, so that's not familiar. But yeah, that makes sense. No, it was, let's say here we are today. We do have air conditioning. We never didn't have air conditioning then. We'd be in a room like this. Might have windows, might have open. It'd be very hot in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And there you were, you know, checking the data and rechecking it and so forth. So, yeah, that was pretty typical of the day. But it made some things more important. These ESP tests were dull now. People say, must have been bored. But that was the only show in town.
Yeah.
And so it was much more interesting then. So.
Yeah, then that's an interesting reflection of what we'll pay attention to and what motivates us, that what back then was very cutting edge and interesting and worth, you know, devoting your time to as a hobby, would today be seen somehow boring, and you can never
Absolutely.
Get yourself quite to grasp it the same way.
Right. I think it's almost like the social history of research, because it has a lot more to do with, we're talking about psychology now, maybe not physics, But psychology, right. It really affects our results, how these little subtle things.
Well, let's jump back to your childhood. I mean, of course, the thread going to the labs and learning about what your father did is important. But you also had different sorts of awareness of what was going around you. And one thing maybe we'll jump to is religion, how you perceived it in your community, at school, and at home.
Yeah, religion, since I mentioned earlier that my folks gave up their religion when they and left their family, religious families, it never came back into our family in an active way. My dad encouraged me, my parents both encouraged me to go along with the neighborhood children to the local church so you'd be part of the community and feel comfortable. And sometimes we would go to services at the chapel, for instance, just to become acquainted and be part of the culture. But it did not become personally important to me. It still isn't. I would call myself spiritual, but not religious in nature. And that was pretty true of the whole family.
How often did you go to church or to some services?
Probably only 4 or 5 times a year. I went to church groups, you know, because it was a good social outlet, a good safe thing. The church had been very important to my parents growing up in terms of the activities and things to do. But that was not the case for me in our family.
Right. And I can definitely empathize with that idea of being spiritual, but not necessarily a churchgoer, religious. But church does build community, and you were obviously cognizant of that. Yeah. Your family was cognizant of that. So I'm just curious, as a little footnote, later on in life, how much you were interested in church, went to services?
Well, I never have been. I'm very interested in the relationship between the work that we do at the Ryan Center and the underlying basis for religion. I think there's lots of implications, and I mean religion as well as spirituality. I think the miracles in the Bible and things like that are the sort of things that many of us study, although we don't talk about where the source of it. We don't talk about, is this from God or is this from some other source? We don't know. But we do know about prophecy and the effect of prayer on living things. And so my father's interest in this field, I think, was basically to find out the basic underlying principles in nature, which one could then see and become religious about, or they could support a religious belief.
Right.
It's not saying it's proof of anything. We don't use that word anyway, proof. But that was his interest. And so he always was friendly to religious people, some of the leading people of the time. I'm just looking right now at the correspondence with Norman Vincent Peale and some other people, Smiley Blanton and people of my father's era. And he had always hoped there'd be a department to study the overlap between parapsychology and religion.
Interesting.
But I don't see it far it affects me personally. It's more in a kind of quiet internal effect rather than an outgoing thing that I would need to go and worship in a public place.
Right. Well, that's such a fascinating point that I want to follow up. Have you gotten any negative reactions in your career as you've been working at the Ryan Center as a psychologist to this idea that maybe research in the paranormal or in psi, whatever you want to call it, is going to help explain or contextualize things that happen in the Bible? Some people feel like, no, you shouldn't be able to research that at all. God's work is different from nature.
I'm sure some people do.
Right.
Yeah. Fortunately, we have been under the radar enough. It hasn't affected me personally, but I know many of people in my area. There's a well-known man named Larry Dossey who's written marvelous books on the power of prayer and the power of premonitions. He's a healer. He's a medical man. He has found some resistance from, I would call it, the more right-wing religious groups. On the other hand, many of the people in the middle think that he himself could walk on water because of what he's doing to bring together the findings of parapsychology and spiritual that underline spiritual belief. In the broader sense, which is what I pay attention to, I think what we're doing is important. If not everybody, conventional religion or conventional science. You know, everybody's got their little domains, and they're hard to shake up old ideas, no matter even if you look at the facts. So I don't expect it's going to change dramatically.
Yeah. Well, we jumped to that from religion in your childhood, and I want to segue to something similar to religion in your childhood, which is just traditions. Maybe there are certain times of year for holidays you went to church services, I'm not sure. But maybe you had other traditions that were important to you that involved cooking something or going out somewhere, meeting certain people.
Well, our family has always been a very gregarious family in the sense that as long as my parents were around, we always had, my sister was the cook and we had big family dinners and then we'd go for a hike or something. We were outdoors people. And Christmas, you know, Christmas and Thanksgiving, all tradition. We did traditional things, but we didn't have anything that was strikingly stands out as to me as unusual.
Okay, so again, it reminds me of how your father is balancing out his unusual side by making his family as normal by by community standards
and
as
he
possible.
And he and my mother grew up in this tradition, so they were like Christians who didn't go to church or who didn't pray. Mm-hmm. You know, I belong to a family. I mean, family now, there'll be prayer, maybe prayer around our kitchen table or the dinner meeting or something, but that because of individual people there. My present husband goes to church, and he occasionally will lead a prayer if we have a family group, and that's just a normal thing. And yet we'll have people in the room who have one faith or no faith. Here they range. That's probably pretty typical of American families today.
Yeah, times have changed. In addition to your family environment, you had this, and your community environment, which seems like it felt pretty insulated sometimes to you, and maybe there wasn't, and without a TV, there wasn't the same sense of connection to the rest of the U.S. and the world that someone could have today on a laptop on the internet or watching TV. But even still, I'm sure you're aware of politics. Maybe things like, I don't know, single out. I mean, there's all kinds of, there's segregation. The Cold War would have been something prominent, maybe around college years. If you could walk us through some of the political events that struck you or maybe changed your perspective.
Going back to World War II, when, of course, we had radio, and my parents were extremely and very involved. My father tried to re-enlist. He had been in World War I, but he was too old for that. And there was a lot of family, a lot of concern, and the lab people, the staff was cut down during that time, and so they had to narrow down their work. So they were very much affected by World War II. We have not had any members of the family, not lost anybody. But other than that, I don't know that there's been any dramatic outside events that have affected our personal lives. I've been, fortunate to have escaped with no, as I say, without any relatives involved in that.
Do you remember more or less how old you were when your father was trying to reenlist in World
War II? Would have been in the, 19 Pearl Harbor was in 1941, so that would have been in the early 40s on there.
Right.
Mid-40s somewhere.
So you'd have been like around middle school.
Right. And then World War II was over in about 45.
Right.
I definitely remember all that. And listening to my parents listening to the radio, and, that's what we were doing, wondering what was going to happen to England. I mean, those were very dramatic times.
And I'm imagining your father was very eager to go help if he wanted to reenlist or something like that.
He was, had been a Marine in World War I. He didn't go overseas, but he was very proud of being a part of the U.S. Marines. He actually won a National Rifle, even though he never held a gun before or afterwards, but he used his time. This is like my father would do. He used his time to practice and get good at something. So then he won the national. And then my brother became a Marine too. So that was something that we were proud of that. And those were days when you could be patriotic about a war, which I don't know has been the case since World War II. I mean, I don't certainly feel very good about any of our wars since then.
Yeah, well, we haven't had the same type of war since.
Not when we were attacked, no.
Mm-mm. Right.
Directly.
Well, okay, so that was the most prominent thing you can remember, and it had some ties to your family. But then I'm sure somehow or another you got some – well, I guess it started with maybe, those nasty Russians or those nasty Germans, and then shifted to those nasty Russians. I think there were some cultural assumptions and – images that were formed of perceived enemies that you might have been exposed to. Do you remember anything about that, or anything that stands out as stereotypical or racist?
No, it doesn't stand out. I've always been a political liberal, and but that has nothing to do with it does have something to do with the Vietnam and then the later wars and so forth. But I don't think that's affected. I don't think that's affected me. I was being an adult and got married and then got divorced and was raising two children. And I was very busy doing my life was absorbed in my own personal struggles during those years in the between the 50s and the 70s or something along in there. Then I got remarried again in 86. And 86. Yeah, And by that time, my children were grown and doing well, and so I was relaxed more. But times of Vietnam and things like that, I was so absorbed making a living that I escaped some of the other issues that might have been good to be involved in. I didn't have time to be an activist.
Right. That's fair. Mm-hmm. And we're already leading up to one element in your adulthood that I want to talk about, which is your experience with therapy, clinical work. Mm-hmm. But before we get there, there's one area that we've been more broad brush about, which is sort of the area between end of high school and when you first mm-hmm. had children. So if you could mm-hmm. help us through how you were changing around then.
Right. Yeah. I left Durham High School, and fortunately, my parents helped me, allowed me and paid my way to go to a college away from home, really, so I could make the break. And that was my beginning to grow up. So I went to the College of Worcester in Ohio, an excellent school, where I happened to meet my current husband. But in those days, it was just a nice break. And it was up at the area where they were from. So, you know, they could feel comfortable going there. Mm. And I still remember a little pep talk that my dad gave me when we parted on that first day. And so, again, he was saying, look, be your own person now. You know, you're not in Durham High School anymore or whatever.
Yeah.
So that was very nice. And I had 4 great years there. Came back home and probably should have gone on to graduate school then. But I sort of messed around and didn't go to graduate school for a while. And then got married and had to sidetrack. It took me quite a while to get back to grad school, which has always been I've been very happy that I did. But it's very difficult to do that, and it's often not fair for little children either to be trying to do both.
Right. Well, remind me what you majored in.
Yeah, I got into a Duke psychology department was an experimental psychologist. At that time, I decided to go into my father's work by that time full time. I did that after college. I knew that's what I really wanted to do. But in order to do that, I needed to have some real good credentials. It's controversial enough if you don't have good credentials. And also, I wanted to learn more about methodology and so forth.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're saying you got a psychology degree at Worcester in Ohio?
No. Yeah. Undergraduate, I got biology. In preparation to be a psychologist. I knew I'd always wanted to be a psychologist. So
That's
it was a matter of how soon and how direct. And then I worked a little while for the parapsychology lab, and then I knew I had to have a doctor's degree. So then I got into Duke, and it took me 6 years, I guess, about 5-6 years to get a doctorate because I had 2 little children and my marriage was breaking up. And those were tough times.
Yeah.
But I'm really glad that I did. I used that and worked at the Duke Parapsychology Lab. At that time, it was independent from Duke. And I worked there for a couple more years. And then I decided I really wanted to go back to my beginning, which was to be a clinical psychologist, where I felt I was more talented and didn't require the patience to be an experimenter.
Yeah. Still, I guess it's a little blander in some sense.
It's a different kind of patience. You have to keep your mouth shut, which is hard to do for me. But you can really be out there and help people and see results, whereas research takes a long, long time, particularly in parapsychology. It's a long, long time before you have to repeat things over and over.
That's fair. Yeah, I mm-hmm. can see that. So then let's talk about you moved from parapsychology at Duke to therapy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What was that like for you?
I really liked it. It was I trained as primarily my interest was in family therapy, but I worked mm-hmm. because of the job situations. I worked at mental health clinics where you could count on a 9-to-5 job and a paycheck, and not. And then later, I got into private practice when my children were older and I didn't have to pay for their high school tuition.
Were these clinics that you were working at?
I started down in Charlotte, Mecklenburg County. Worked there for a couple years, and then I came back to Durham and worked in the Durham area. First, I worked out in Butner, mm-hmm. and there's a Children's Psychiatric Institute out there. I worked there and a couple other mental health centers that are in the area. I worked with them also at the same time. Then I ended up in Durham Mental Health Center, where I worked for about 11 years. Hmm. By that time, my children were old enough, I could see going into private practice, and that takes a certain amount of energy because you have to wait for the business. It's probably even harder today.
Yeah. Well, you had these clinics in Charlotte, Durham, mm-hmm. Various places. It's sounding to me, and see, I'm learning so much just by mm-hmm. just through this interview, it sounded to me like you lived and worked always within North Carolina. Is that true?
Until I married in 1986, and then I moved away to New Jersey for 5 years with my present husband, Bill Hendrickson. Mm. And we lived up there, and I worked a little bit as a psychologist, didn't have to work quite so much. And then moved back here again, back to North Carolina, because I had land, and Bill, we were ready to give up the high prices in New Jersey and come back to North Carolina.
Ready to come home.
Ready to come home where I'm living on the property, which was my parents' place. So, full circle.
Yeah, circle of life.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's keep talking about the therapy because I want to see what insights you have from it or what get some of the details of what your specialty was maybe. Mm-hmm. So family therapy. Let's set that up. Your clinics nearby where we're having this interview in Chapel Hill, I guess, or a good drive away sometimes. Mm-hmm. And you would have multiple people come into sessions. Like you might have mother, daughter, whole family?
Well, I actually began the training as family therapy when I was in Charlotte. And then thereafter, we weren't always able to duplicate. That's an expensive kind of therapy to manage. You can't always have them present. But if you can, it works. But even if they're only one person in the room, you can think of them, much like we're doing this interview, where you know the family, you know where they came from, you know what their values are, even if grandma's not in the room to say, to show you directly, you know the impact upon her life if she was a salient person in your client's life. So I viewed my work in family context, but then it ended up mainly where you could get the work, and working with children was wonderful for a while, but I found it was very hard to work with parents, with children without the parents. When the parents would come in, we really got a lot done. So I gravitated more into working with adults in marital problems, where people will come in and they'll pay when their marriage is in trouble. They don't come in and pay if their child's is having a lot of trouble. They'll just, put it off because it doesn't. Yeah.
I feel like they can handle it.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And of course, I don't know about today because I haven't been in practice since 2007. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how bad it's getting now, but I suppose it's any easier now than it was then.
Well, I was just curious about the children that you started off with, and you had trouble just with them on their own to really get a sense of their
family.
Well,
you'd feel like you're not getting any. I mean, you could have a great hour, and some of the old-fashioned methods which I worked with, you spend an hour with a child who's autistic, and you spend a whole hour with them, and you hope you're having some influence and helping them, but you don't really know. But if mom comes in, and you can work with mom and son together, then you can work out plans that she can implement at home, and you get feedback. It's just much more effective.
Right.
And so I think that's the basic way of working with children. It's different when you got a 13-year-old teenager who won't talk in front of mom.
Right.
But up until that age.
So you were working with an age range something like 5 to 13?
I did it from all ages, at different times, depending upon what clinic I was in or whatever, or where you were.
So tell us more, once you started moving to adults, and I guess you said you moved to adults with marital problems, what flavor or style you had as a therapist? Like, I think even though there's always some attempt in the therapeutic community to standardize procedures, every therapist has a little different. Some maybe talk more than others, some listen more. Maybe provide more suggestions, and others ask more questions. They have different beliefs. That's one other thing.
True. So, and it does change over time too. I probably was much more of a Rogerian and just sort of listened at the very beginning. But except for the family therapy input that I had from a mentor in Charlotte who helped me realize the importance of the family. So I try to had two or three different models in my mind. If person was say a blue collar worker and he wasn't going to understand a truck driver or occasional policeman. I can't remember. There were many of them that ever would come in. You would work in very much behavioral terms, very practical, automatic, and think of something clever like having him look at his wife over the table for 5 minutes every evening or something behavioral.
Yeah.
I still remember the first little girls, a teenager that I ever worked with, was having a terrible time with her father at the supper table. Mm-hmm. And so her assignment was to spend 1 minute or half a second, just a short period of time, and she had to look at him eyeball to eyeball that evening. And she came back the next time I saw him, and she was amazed at the difference.
By looking him in the eye.
So the behavioral things for some people, and of course, much more thoughtful things for somebody who wanted to, or was able to reflect internally. I have not done intensive individual one-on-one therapy because I think you need more training for that, sort of the psychodynamic type. I always wanted to, but I was working at clinics where time and money didn't allow a lot of that, although I began to do some of that later.
Yeah, I was surprised I didn't hear more of a Freudian spin on what you were doing. And so you would say that's partly because of some lack of preparation and Freudian psychoanalysis, psychodynamics.
Well, it's partly the way your clinic is set up and what people are coming for. And I wasn't in one place long enough to private practice. If I had stayed in private practice and focused on that instead of getting diverted into, I think, a little bit of ADHD, because I've always got so many things going on in my life that I didn't focus on that as deeply as I might have. I can see it's valid, but I can also see I've gotten some dramatic results with couples by maneuvering them and giving them assignments and working on their dynamics together, you know. And when I see that as very practical and immediate, and when people coming and they want help, it's kind of like you have to have several models that you can work with. Yeah. And also what potential you see in that person, how reflective they are. That's a basic thing too. Psychodynamic therapy does not work for the truck driver. I shouldn't be unfair to truck drivers.
So saying if someone's less reflective, it's going to be harder to dig deep into their thought patterns.
At least at first, you'd better get some results first.
So better to do behavioral focused, pragmatic.
Yeah. And then if something works and they want to explore further, but,
So that'd be a case of sort of selling that what you're doing is important, maybe even. There might be some people, if they're not reflective, they might also think, I don't need therapy.
Well, let's just go back to the girl who looked at her father, began to look with her father after she ran an effect. Then you might have to say, well, you know, what's going on there? What were you thinking? What do you think he was? And then you could go into it. But, because that's certainly more than just looking at somebody. And there's a lot involved in that experience.
Right. Well, honestly, it sounds to me like the sort of therapy you've done is similar to what's in vogue these days, which is like cognitive behavioral therapy, for example. It's like the prominent form of talk therapy that gets the most research money. Yeah, and it's basically just changing people's patterns of behavior and some of their basic patterns of thought without looking very carefully where they came from or people's history. It's more just finding some application. Some people think that's bad or good.
Well, it's expedient, and it may be all the insurance pays for. If you have chance, you know, how will it really last? If you happen to come back in 5 months, 2 months, 5 months, see him later, maybe you're ready to do something else. I think you have to have a model, a really good model behind there, and then let's see what's practical.
So you're skeptical about being too practical all the time.
It's clearly a means to an end, but for some people, that may be all they want or need or are going to take.
Right.
And I do think there's a role for that in this crazy world, you know. We should be teaching that in school, really.
And at this point, actually, it's worth saying that kind of behavioral therapy, even though you'd portray it as something quick in, quick out, insurance coverage, there's something even farther along that extreme on the continuum, which is just go to a psychiatrist, take an anti-anxiety drug, don't talk at all, right?
Right. And I really dread that because I think that's what is happening. To the world.
Right. Yeah, sort of medicating away. And
yeah. You're going to have some good programs with some other people on this topic because these are big, big topics.
Right, right.
And important ones.
Yeah, I've yet to have a psychiatrist on. I hope they won't be shy or someone interested in psychopharmacology. But look, we've covered so much ground that I want to rehash a little bit. So we somehow started with your family tree, with your childhood and how it shaped your experiences. It turns out so if you'd want to summarize from your childhood what your impression was of your parents and how it compares to what you think their public image is, maybe that'd be one of the parting things to reflect on.
Yeah.
Do you think their public image is somehow skewed compared to how you know them?
Not for people who really knew them. I don't know what comes across in the, you know, the media or whatever, and certainly today, because things are so forgotten today or so incorrect. If you look on Wikipedia, you see things that are very false.
Well, give me an example of that, actually, because, you know, anyone can have Wikipedia. I could go and fix it right now.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, I just remembered when I checked what I had seen earlier and what I wrote here. I know there were some errors, but I don't remember what they were. Didn't realize I could correct it myself. But I think their persona to people who knew them up front and the people who worked with them. Now, my dad could be tough. You know, he was a tough person to work with, and I'm not sure I wanted to stay working with him forever. But he was also one of the most gentle, most kind, and most honest people I've ever known. So, you know, very much true to what he said he was. And same with my mother. She was softer, but she wasn't a pushover either. So they were both very, very, I would do so well to be such a good parent.
Well, that's a very resounding endorsement of their approach in the family. It sounds, I'm glad to hear about you and to hear that you had a good life, it sounds like, and that you've been very productive and shared so much about what you learned being a therapist. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much, Jose. It's been fun to be with you.
This is WCOM-FM LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. Check us out online at wcomfm.org.